Oak Session number 13718, Reel 1.
And say that.
Could I ask you first, Mr. Bristow, when were you born?
I was born on 22nd of November 1899.
And where?
Cardiff. That's where I lived.
Yeah. Can you, just before we go on to your flying experiences, can you just give me a resume of your family background and upbringing and so on in those days?
Yes, I can. My father had built up a business of his own. Which was a glass merchant in Cardiff, and I suppose when the war started, I don't know how old he would be. I don't suppose he was 50, but he'd ventured and built this business up on his own, and it was of some consequence in the town. And by the time the war had ended, of course, it grew rapidly during the war, as many businesses did, because the war effort was building of factories and buildings of various kinds, produced shells and so on. I imagine that he got into all that and got quite respectable orders for glazing these buildings. And so the business grew fairly quickly. And the wartime conditions, although when the war broke out, people thought almost the end of the world was coming, and they realized that it was business as usual, which became a catchword after a while. But, of course, the most profound changes took place very rapidly, namely that we had a very small army to begin with, and we had to build up a big one quickly, which meant that all the young men were required to go. Conscription hadn't come in yet. And Lord Kitchener made that famous appeal, "Your King and country need you," with that famous picture of him pointing his finger at you, which came over on advertisement hoardings. And young men, I mean, it was the spirit entered into it, and they felt that with the German advance and invading poor little Belgium and the so-called atrocities that were reported at the time, which of course were grossly exaggerated, as we found later. But anyway, it was an invasion of a small country, and people responded to that, and they wanted to fight and stop this menace. One has to remember, of course, that there had been plenty of warnings that this sort of thing could happen for some years before, because there was this rivalry with the growth of Germany and its military spirit that prompted its growth very largely, building a very large army, and also trying to vie with the British in building a navy. So every time we built another dreadnought or battleship, the Germans followed suit with another one. And this rivalry went on before the war for, several years.
This, of course, is recorded history.
It's recorded history, undoubtedly. But I'm just giving you the background now to the kind of situation in which I grew up.
Yes.
So here was a schoolboy, with all of this going on around, and young men going, and there wasn't very much difference in age between me then and those who were going. And we soon found out that it was a very vicious war. There was appalling losses on both sides, and we got used to these casualty lists appearing from time to time. So it was a war atmosphere in which I matured.
So you, at the age of, 14 you were when war broke out?
When war broke out, I was 14.
Were you swept up with the same feelings that you were describing about...
Indeed. Everybody was. The very few exceptions were people who had searched their souls and thought this was a very wicked thing and we shouldn't participate. And fortunately for this country, very quickly, other... people said, well, if people really feel like this in their conscience, they should be compelled to join the forces. We must put them somewhere else, give them other work to do, not combatant work, but anyway work that would assist in the war effort. So they went on the land, or they became stretcher bearers, and so on. So the conscientious objectors and the tribunals that were set up in all towns where these people, it came to the point that they had to go and they refused, so they were referred to the tribunal. And the tribunals were composed of local people, lawyers, clergymen, people like that, who sat and decided that this was a really sincere case. Therefore, they should be, you know, recognized as conscientious objectors and not compelled to go into the forces. This happened fairly early on. I think it's very good to think back and realize that we were enlightened enough anyway to accept this point of view and try and cope with it. I'm digressing here because, you see, the war is going on. I'm living in a war atmosphere. What was I doing all this time? Well, I was a schoolboy, but I was also an ardent Boy Scout. And whilst we didn't do direct war work, because of war conditions, I suppose the war conditions meant that we soon felt, you know, the difficulties of food that's been so plentiful hitherto, and we realized how much was imported and how our lifeline now was our shipping lanes from other parts of the world, and how the Germans built submarines because this was their way of trying to retaliate and to, as it were, starve this country into submission, because there was stalemate by this time, of course, on the Western Front with this trench warfare. So I grew up and matured in that sort of atmosphere. I think it was one of the best things that ever happened to me that I was a Boy Scout. I was in a very good troop stationed in the junior YMCA in Cardiff, and it made us very self-reliant. We were very keen on camping, and we used to go out at weekends in the summer regularly and for longer periods in our school holidays. And it gave me a sense of reliance and knowledge about looking after myself very largely. I think it did me good. Well, anyway, the time came when time was going on. The war seemed to be endless, and my friends were going, joining the colours. Some went into the army, a few went into the navy, and at that time, don't forget, there was no air force. The army had its branch, the Royal Flying Corps, and the navy had its flying branch, the Royal Naval Air Service. And we realized that to get into the infantry and to get bogged down on the entrenched warfare was a very dangerous and a very unpleasant thing. And I suppose we thought, well, I'm not going to be caught up in that. I'll try and do something else, get into some other sort of combative operation. And I had a friend, I think, who had joined the Royal Naval Air Service, and through that, I suppose, I made inquiries and thought, this is what I'd like to do. So I suppose these thoughts passed through one's mind at least a year before one came to one's 18th birthday, at which time, of course, one would automatically, by that time, be conscripted, because I think conscription came in about 1915, when it was felt that although an enormous intake of men had taken place by that time, that everybody automatically at the age of 18 should go into the armed forces. There had been no age limit either down or up before that, as far as I know, except the normal one that applied for recruiting. So I made inquiries and found out that I would have to apply to Royal Navy and its air arm, the Royal Naval Air Service, at the Hotel Cecil in the Strand in London. Wrote in, got the requisite papers, and I suppose returned them, and then eventually was summoned to an interview. This was when I was about 17 and a half. So I went up to London and presented myself and was set before a board, which was three naval officers, who asked quite a lot of questions about my education and why I wanted to join the Royal Naval Air Service. I suppose I gave adequate answers. I also had some testimonials, I think, that I must have had from local people, Probably had to provide two of those. I can't remember quite what they were, but I'd, at any rate, I provided what was necessary. And it seemed that after appearing before them for about a quarter of an hour, and I was ushered out of the room and then told to go for a medical examination, which I had there and then. And then I was told that, yes, I would be accepted. Go back home and you'll be called up later.
What made you want to fly rather than go to sea?
Well, I thought I'd do both by joining the Royal Naval Air Service.
But obviously flying...
I think I had always had... I'd always been very interested in the sea. Sailing, I used to read a lot about it and got very familiar with types of warships and merchant ships and all the rest of it. And a sort of glamorous attachment to the sea. But here was a new... a force being created, and a very specialized kind, and I thought, this is the one for me. Apparently I satisfied them, and at this interview, that I had the requisite knowledge to acquire further knowledge and become specialized and taught to fly. Well, anyway, in due course I was summoned to go to the Royal Naval College, Greenwich. This was towards the end of 1917, due time. I was sent a list of all my requirements of uniform, because, of course, in those days one had to provide one's own uniform, which I promptly did, and then presented myself at the Royal Naval College, Greenwich. And I arrived with a mixed bunch of other men. Some were English, like myself, but a lot of them were Canadians. At the same time, a lot had been recruited in Canada, and the squad I got into was at least half Canadians, which was very interesting and amusing in many ways, because they had very quaint expressions. We were put through the usual procedure, that is, we had drill. That was presented no problems to me at all, because I had been drilling before when I was a scout. And rather to their surprise, I seemed to be able to bark across the parade square that we had there at the Royal Naval College. They could hear me at the far end, and I knew all the drill movements, which was a great help to me in a way, because I looked a very babyish sort of recruit, I think, at that time, particularly compared to some of these very big, rough-looking Canadians who had come over. Never mind, we all got on very well together. Then we had lectures in navigation, principles of flight, aircraft engines and armament. They were a piece of cake to me, actually, because I hadn't long left school and I was fairly good at scholastic subjects, and they didn't present any problem or terrors for me, really. And I found that I was a little bit better than most of these Canadians who came over in the questioning. Some of them used to get quite nervous and worried about the short tests and examinations we had to have. Anyway, after that preliminary training in Greenwich, I was detailed to go with a few others one day to the flying school that the Navy had at Vendôme, which was in the middle of France, somewhere near Tours. We'd heard about this, but we'd heard about other stations in other parts of the country, but by pure chance I was detailed to go to Vendôme, which I did with a small number of other recruits, and off we went to Folkestone and across the channel by train to Paris, and then by train again from Paris down to Vendôme. I suppose the whole transfer took probably 24 hours or more in those days, because whilst the train service was working in France, and was very busy, obviously, with all the troop movements and so on. But some parts of the journey south are not all that far from the front, from the firing line. So I don't suppose the route from Paris down to Vendôme was as direct as it is today. Nevertheless, we got to Vendôme, and there we were met with a three-ton Leyland truck and taken the 6 miles from the little town of Vendôme to the air station, which was out in the countryside, a very big airfield indeed, divided into two parts. on the one side were the initial hangars where the Codron G3s were housed and where we were divided into flights, and on the other side of the complex there, which was the main office, I suppose, and the parade ground, and many of the living quarters, and on the other side was the part where the Curtiss J3s were established, where we passed on after passing out on Codron G3s. And I think on the first day we arrived, or the day after, we were divided into flights and all given a flight. My first flight, I remember, I sat in this Codron G3. There were two seats in a small nacelle. I sat in the back seat, the instructor in the front seat, a dual control, and he had sort of headphones on, which I did too, connected to his voice pipe by a rubber tube, and he gave me instructions in that way. We strapped in, and he opened up, and off we taxied, and up we went. And this was my first flight in an aircraft. I was surprised how very quickly we seemed to get up speed, and before you knew it, you were airborne, and there was the ground slowly receding beneath you. It seemed to me to be a wonderful performance. And as we climbed, so the instructor said, now put your hand on the controls, your feet on the rudder bar, and your hand on the joystick, and feel what I'm doing. And I did. And he said, don't you put any pressure on, you just follow my movements. And he showed me how to bank the aircraft, that's to turn it left or right, how to go up or how to come down, and with the throttle controls, how to control the engine revs. It was kept at maximum, near maximum revs, in order to keep us airborne and to gain height. And of course, to come down and land, we were taught to go around in a big circuit, get headed into wind well over the edge of the airfield, judge your height, and at the right time, throttle back, put the joystick forward, and get the aircraft into a shallow dive, about 1 in 7, watch your airspeed indicator and keep your airspeed up, and merely by the aircraft gliding. And as you came very near the ground, you had to, by delicately holding the joystick, move the elevator so that you leveled off, and you hoped to level off when the wheels were about a foot off the ground. And then you made a very gentle landing on the airfield. It was all grass, of course.
That method of flying and circuit patterns and things like that was obviously established very early on in the history of aviation.
Must have been.
Because it's standard practice now in flying clubs, for instance, or anywhere.
Yes.
Where you have techniques of flying.
Right.
Did you wear parachutes?
No. Never heard of them. well, we had heard of parachutes.
Yeah.
That's not true. I mean, everybody.
They
weren't standard issue at all. No. Parachutes were only used by observers in observation balloons on the Western Front.
Yeah.
Because those poor chaps, there they were in their balloons at about 3,000 feet altitude, spotting for the artillery behind the lines, and, of course, by their telephone wire, directing how the shells were falling. And German aircraft would try and shoot them down. Well, just puncturing them wouldn't send them down, but you had to have tracer ammunition, which would be a small shell which would blaze, of course, but burning, and get inside the envelope and set the thing on fire. And then, of course, it was a very rapid descent indeed. This poor fellow had to jump quickly and see that he jumped clear of the descending balloon.
Anyhow, you had your first flight, and you then obviously went on to go solo. Can you remember how many hours flying it took you to go solo?
Some people seem to get the knack of it and go solo quickly. Others took longer. It's very difficult to know why. I think it depended very largely on the instructor. The instructor should convey to the pupil the basic elements of flying and should see that he can do it. It's very easy to learn. Once you're up in the sky, it seems so easy. The problem is to get up there, and the bigger problem is to get down safely. Getting down, landing was the problem. And it took longer to learn that than anything else. I suppose the reason was a question of judgment, getting used to... I'll go on.
Yes, do.
I'll go on. Well, I think it depended a lot on the instructor. Some were very good and some were not so good. After all, they were very young men, most of them. What was I? I was just 18, and I suppose some of them were the very advanced age of 20 or 21, who had themselves learned probably the year before and had some operational skill and then been detailed to be instructors for some reason or other. Obviously, they would send a man to be an instructor if they felt he was good at instructing. But some are better than others. This is a question of personality and a knack of getting things over to people and of getting their confidence. When learning, I was in the hand of one man for, I should think, several flights, probably totaling 2 or 3 hours. I was then passed on to another man who was slightly senior to him, I think. And this was the one who finally, I think, was the one who had to determine that I was ready to go solo or not. I had been given several tests in saying, look, cut the engine back and land here, which was finding a good field and landing. These sort of things, taking you unawares, were tests, I suppose, as to one's capacity to deal with an emergency and to react and to see how one did it. That, by the way, some people learnt in about 3 to 4 hours. I think I took 6 to 7 hours. I was not exceptional. I was among many people who took a bit longer than others. It may be that it was my own temperament. It may not have been. All I can say is that being a very cautious person, I suppose I wanted to be quite sure of everything, and I never had any problems in flying after I learned to go solo. I was able to accommodate myself to getting onto other types of aircraft fairly quickly, whereas other people who learnt fairly quickly got overconfident, and during the time that I was in Vendôme, I suppose I was there for about 2 months. During that time, I witnessed over 30 crashes, only 2 of them fatal. Most of them were by people making very bad landings. And it is quite likely that a person who seemed to be ready to fly very quickly probably hadn't had long enough experience, got a little bit reckless, and it is quite easy to have a bad landing by misjudging either your height above the ground when you leveled off, or coming in too fast, because whatever happened, the machine would go down and would bounce. And in bouncing, of course, you lost more speed, and on the next bounce, you would turn over on your nose. I saw many crashes of that kind. The man inside wasn't hurt. He was strapped in, and you would see this poor figure finally emerge, having undone his safety strap and getting out of the wreckage and switching off the petrol, which we were all taught to do, obviously, in case it spilt and got on the hot cylinders and blew up. But I never saw any fires at all after these crashes.
Was it an easy aeroplane to fly?
I think the Codron was quite an easy aeroplane to fly. It had warped controls. It meant that the joystick was very heavy. You had to press it quite a lot to warp the wings, but you had to be very gentle with the up and the fore and aft motion to control the elevators, that's to go up or down. But once you got airborne and got high enough up, you could throw them about in the air and do almost anything with them. They were remarkable little aircraft and very strong.
Had you been taught spin recovery in those days?
No. Maybe we used to try and spin them. We did spin them. But they were not very easy to spin, and they would automatically recover. It was a very inherently stable aircraft was the Codron G3, and I think a very good choice to learn to fly.
Did it have a rotary engine?
It had a rotary engine. It had 110 horsepower Anzani, 10-cylinder, that is two banks of five, and a propeller, I suppose, was about 5 feet.
And it's so your throttle control as such was done by flicking the magneto switch on and off, was it?
That's right, yes.
Which didn't lead to smooth engine control then?
No, you had a magneto, but you could throttle back on this radial engine, have it running slowly or fast. There was no problem about it. Quite different from a rotary engine.
I thought you said you had a rotary engine.
No, a radial engine.
A radial,
an Anzani radial engine, yes. Oh, that was straightforward, just to open and close the throttle and adjust it to whatever position you wanted. No difficulty.
My understanding of the need for rotary engines was that the forward airflow over the aircraft wasn't sufficient to cool the engine. Therefore, you had to give it extra speed by rotating it. Is that correct?
That was the theory. You see, the one that we had, the Anzani, which had 10 cylinders and 110 horsepower, there were no problems of overheating as far as I remember. We never had any difficulty about that. In any case, we just accepted what there was. I think at the time that in trying to get greater horsepower, bigger cylinders in a static radial engine, it created problems. And other people were experimenting and said, why not hold the crankshaft and let the engine go round? It'll get a lot more air circulating around it, which in theory was right. I think it was right in practice also, because I flew two aircraft with rotary engines. One was a small seaplane, the Hempel Baby, which had a gnome rotary. That's a gnome rotary, that's right, 110 horsepower. And also a small flying boat, which had the similar engine as a pusher behind the biplane, which suspended, of course, the boat. They were a bit tricky, because you had to manipulate the throttle in such a way that the engine would not stop. You had to keep it spinning, but you didn't want it to be going and giving you any propulsive power, so it had to revolve slowly. And to do that, you had a blip switch, which cut the magneto, and then you released the switch when the engine was nearly stopping to let it pick up again, so you could blip yourself down onto the water in that way. It was quite easy when you got used to it, but that was the method of controlling the propulsive power of a rotary engine. Well, as far as passing out is concerned and flying and going solo, once you went solo, and I did go solo one evening, and I did everything right and came down, made a good landing, taxied in and so on, and I felt on top of the world. All I wanted was to do it and realize that I could do it myself, because after that there were no problems at all.